Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Scott Kowalty spent many years teaching at the University of Northern Iowa, but during that time, he was also active in the local music scene, and he wrote a weekly column for Cedar Valley Readers for more than 40 years. Now that he has written his last column, he and I will take a look back later in the hour. But first, you are probably familiar with the work of Isabel Bloom, whether you know it or not. Concrete sculptures of animals, children, angels, other designs inspired by nature. The sculptures of Isabel Bloom have been beloved since the 1950s, and there are many imitators. But even after her death in 2001, Isabel Bloom sculptures are made in Davenport. This hour, we'll find out about the life of the remarkable Iowa artist behind those whimsical sculptures. And Donna Young is co-owner of Isabel Bloom Incorporated. She is also an artist who worked very closely with Bloom and carried on her legacy. Hello, Donna.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
And before we talk about the sculptures and about the method for producing these sculptures that Isabel Bloom developed, I want to go back in time and talk about her life, her development as an artist. And I was surprised to learn that if times had been different, she might have ended up being a fashion designer instead of a sculptor. Could you tell me a little bit about her early work?
Well, Isabel, always the entrepreneur. She took some sewing classes with Singer Sewing and decided that she wanted to open up her own dress shop. So she designed formal gowns, one-of-a-kind gowns for people for a few years. But kind of felt like that's something, if she was going to pursue that as her career, she would need to be in a bigger city, and she didn't want to move. So she turned to her next love, which was sculpting.
And she grew up in Davenport, Iowa, but I kind of find it interesting that she was even really thinking of pursuing a career at the time that she was exploring her options.
Exactly.
Because this was the 1920s.
Exactly. Not a lot of women did that back then. They got married and raised their family, and which Isabel did that as well. But she, you know, she was an artist from the very beginning. And, you know, as a small child, she always knew that she wanted to be an artist. And she used to tell me that her mother would always exclaim how Isabel always saw shapes in the puddles and shapes in the clouds. And I think that's a big part of being an artist, is just being observant and, you know, noticing the beauty in nature around you. And Isabel was like that from a very young child.
And she had a real moment of serendipity. In 1932, she was at the Davenport Municipal Art Gallery, which is now the Museum of Art, and she picked up a handout, just a pamphlet,
right,
for the art colony in Stone City, which a lot of us have heard of because this was Grant Wood's art colony in Stone City. And she just decided that she would go there?
That's right. That's right. I think tuition was $15, and she, you know, was a working woman at the time, so had the money and signed up. And she said it was, you know, it was summer camp for artists, and it lasted for 2 summers. And I think it greatly influenced her life, not only her artistic life, but that's where she met her future husband as well.
So she went to the art colony, and a lot of people have studied this brief moment in time that was this remarkable colony of really incredible artists. She studied painting, composition, and sculpture. So when she went there, it sounds like she didn't really have a clear idea of what her passion, what her real focus would be.
I think that's true. And there was only one instructor, one female instructor there, and that female instructor taught sculpting and carving, and they had plenty of limestone in Stone City. So they, you know, she tried her hand at carving the limestone, and, you know, I think that she fell in love with that medium.
And even at that time, she seemed to be really inspired by scenes from nature, right?
Yes. Just, you know, like I said, she was a very observant lady and just noticed the things around her, you know, the animals that she saw. She sculpted from memory and from observation.
Now, you mentioned that she met her husband there. To be able to afford his tuition, he was also the groundskeeper at that art colony. What was his focus? What kind of artist was he?
Well, he was a wonderful drawer, sketch artist, and he actually taught some classes at the Chicago Art Institute, and Grant Wood saw some of his work in Chicago and recognized the talent that John had in his drawing, and so Grant Wood invited him to Stone City, and John said, well, I can't afford that, and he said, well, I want you to come, so how about if you're groundskeeper? And so, yeah, that was something that Grant Wood actually reached out to John and insisted that he come.
And she later described that summer of 1932 as being just a really magical experience in many ways, although they both went back again in 1933, and she kind of felt like the magic was gone, didn't she?
Yeah, she said that Grant Wood was, he was like the father figure of this group of artists, and they would have dinners together on Sunday night around long picnic tables covered with red and white checkered tablecloths. I mean, I think she has had a lot of vivid memories of those days. But then the following summer, I don't know what Grant Wood was busy doing, but he wasn't present on a day-to-day basis at the art colony, and I think that's what she really missed.
So after her time at the art colony, she and John ended up getting married in 1938. But during that time, I mean, did she pursue her art?
She did. She actually took some ceramic classes and worked in clay, and that led her to, I think this might have been once they were married, to purchase her own kiln so that she could fire her work. But she continued to pursue her art.
And once they did get married, they had three boys. And again, this is not a time when women worked and were also mothers. What do we know about how she continued exploring her artistic side while being a full-time mom?
Well, you know, she used to talk about the home that they purchased on Vine Street. It was up high on the hill overlooking the Mississippi River, and it had a walkout basement that actually used to be the kitchen of the home. So it must have been a basement that had a lot of natural light, and this walkout basement, she was able to watch her boys play in the backyard while she did sculpting in her basement.
And she became a really well-known artist locally. Can you give me an idea of what kind of role she played in the Davenport, in the Quad Cities community?
Well, she was an artist. She was a business owner. She was a huge community supporter. She was very involved with the art scene. She was a founding member of Studio 15, which was a group of 15 artists. And, you know, she was part of Friends of Art, which was a group that raised funds for the art museum. So she was very involved. All this while raising her three active boys, and then in the 50s, she had her own television show too for children that was called Let's Make Believe, and it ran for I think about 4 years. It was live television on Saturday mornings where she would teach a lesson. First, she would tell a story, and the story, she would illustrate the story with little figures that she made out of clay or fabric or whatnot, and then she'd paint the background, and then that was the first half of the show, and the second half of the show, there would be an art lesson. So she was always involved in working with art, working with children, teaching art, promoting art. It was just who she was.
Now, she had been doing a lot of work in ceramics and teaching ceramics classes, but during the late 1940s and the 1950s, she began to experiment with this idea of concrete sculpture. Can you tell me what really spurred her on?
Well, I think she just realized that garden sculpture was something that was kind of lacking in the area. There really wasn't a lot of beautiful sculptures that were accessible to her or her friends for the garden. So she thought this was a niche that she could fit into quite easily. And cement was a very inexpensive, readily available material. And so she actually, in the beginning, she used cement much like you use clay, where she would build a metal armature to support her work, and then she would mix up the cement until it got to like a consistency of clay, and she would actually mold it around the metal armature until, you know, layer by layer, until she had, built a sculpture from the inside out. And now this would be a one-of-a-kind sculpture. Right. So, you know, once she sold it, it would be gone, and she'd have to make another one. And it was years later that she decided, I need to make molds of these things so that I can reproduce them. And, you know, and that's when the business began.
Well, and it's, I think we'll talk more about her legacy as we go on today. But just thinking about a time when garden sculpture wasn't common shows us her incredible impact.
Exactly.
Once she started selling these sculptures, a lot of people copied the idea and created similar things.
That's right. Cement was a material that you used for construction, not for art.
Right. Now, when she was doing those sculptures, I've looked at pictures, and I think they look quite different from what I think about as Isabel Bloom today. Can you give me an idea of the kinds of things she was making when she first started experimenting with that?
Well, a lot of her pieces were commissioned pieces. So she had a doctor who commissioned her to do a sculpture of him working with a patient. She did, many years later, she did a life-size falcon for West High School. That's their mascot. She did a mother reading to her son, so two separate sculptures for the Bettendorf Library. And those sculptures are still in existence, all the pieces that I just named. So a lot of them were pieces that people asked her to do, right, specific sculptures.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. And we're getting to the point where Isabel Bloom became the artist that so many people know and love today. I'm talking with Donna Young. She is the co-owner of Isabel Bloom Incorporated in Davenport. We are talking about the life and work of Isabel Bloom, who passed away back in 2001. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll talk to Scott Kowalty. He wrote a column for Cedar Valley Readers for more than 40 years and recently wrote his last column. He and I will take a look back in a few minutes. Right now, we're talking about Isabel Bloom. You probably are familiar with her work. You've probably seen her concrete sculptures. Many are given as gifts or appear in gardens around the state and around the country, around the world, actually. The sculptures are still made in Davenport, but Isabel Bloom passed away in 2001. And right now I'm talking with Donna Young. She is co-owner of Isabel Bloom Incorporated. She's also an artist who worked closely with Bloom and carries on her legacy today. And Donna, we were talking about how Isabel Bloom started experimenting with cement sculptures and thinking about garden sculptures and realized that she needed to come up with a way of producing more than one of each design. So tell me a little bit about the process that she put together.
Well, and it's a pretty amazing process, and it's very simple and straightforward, and it's pretty much the same process we do today. Everything is very manual, very handmade. So once the original sculpture has been sculpted in clay, the mold, we have a mold maker that will brush latex on that mold. So latex, it is what it is. It's natural latex that comes from the rubber tree, and it's brushed on the clay original, layer at a time, and when it builds up to a certain thickness, then it's time for the outer mold. And the outer mold is made of plaster of Paris, So it's just industrial plaster, and that plaster is applied to the latex piece by piece. And, you know, we've got to draw. It's kind of hard to explain, but parting lines have to be drawn on the piece. And this is actually why her designs are so simple, too, because this method of making molds, there are no seams. The latex will be pulled off like a glove. And so everything needs to be very compact and very together, not a lot of arms and hands flying out in the air. You know, everything's very tight. And if you look at Isabel's designs and now my designs, they're very compact and simple. And so her style, she knew how she was going to reproduce these, so she knew how she had to sculpt. So then once that plaster outer gets made, our casters will mix up the cement in a big mixing barrel and add different dyes depending on what color we're going to pour it in. And the cement is cement, sand, water, and sometimes gravel. And it gets mixed up, poured into the mold. We put it on vibrating tables to get all the bubbles out, and then it sets up overnight. And then the next day, the mold gets pulled off, and the bottom piece of the piece gets filed, and then it goes through a finishing process, which is also very hands-on and labor-intense. And some pieces, it might take several days to get all the finish on that we're going to put on, and some, it's maybe just one step. So it just kind of depends.
How did Isabel Bloom find her audience for these sculptures? As we were talking about before the break, she became extremely prominent in the Quad Cities. Her work was loved. She did a lot of different things, both in local television and at the library and teaching ceramics courses. How did her sculptures find this large audience that really allowed her to start mass producing and sending these around the country?
Well, I think most of her audience found her, but she did talk about wanting an outlet for her work. So she actually did pack up some of her things, get on the bus, take it to Chicago, walk up and down Michigan Avenue until she found a shop, and it was called Hoops on Michigan Avenue. And it was she said she walked in with her things. And I can still hear Isabel telling this story. She said the gentleman inside said, I've been looking for someone like you all my life. And he sold everything that she could make for him. So that was her first, retail outlet was in Chicago. And then since then, she added several gift shops that also carried her work. And then, of course, she had her own shop, which was in the village of East Davenport for many, many, many years.
And she was always deeply committed to staying in Davenport, wasn't she?
Yeah, that's where they raised their family, and she loved Davenport, and she loved the community, and she loved to travel, but she loved coming back home too. So she did a lot of, she loved going to Russia, and she traveled all over the world, and those trips influenced her work probably just as much as the local scene influenced her work.
When you look at her work from the time that she started selling these garden sculptures on Michigan Avenue to the time when she mostly retired, can you see an evolution? How did things change for her?
I guess maybe I would say she started sculpting smaller things. You know, I think her oldest pieces are the larger pieces, and then she started doing a little bit of smaller things. But I don't think her style changed much. She just did a lot more, at first it was, hugging children and bird watcher and violet, and then it was the robin and the wren and the bunny rabbit and things like that, and fish. She loved fish, too.
When she spoke about these things that she sculpted, she talked about how, an artist can make these forms, can make children or animals, but she said that it was easy to make them without soul, and she felt that her items contained soul. Having known her, having worked with her, what do you think she meant by that?
Well, I think she meant, Isabel, a lot of what Isabel did was kind of self-taught, where she just learned from experience. And it was just, she was who she was, and she wasn't trying to necessarily please anyone or copy anyone. Everything she did was, I guess, came from within. And her style just, you know, I don't think she intentionally said, this is going to be my style. You know, what you see is what you get with Isabel, and that's just what her pieces are like, too.
When she was 73 years old, she decided to sell the business, and that's kind of the moment where you enter this story.
Yeah.
Tell me about that moment in time when she decided to sell the business and when you became a part of Isabel Bloom.
Well, I just, you know, in looking back, I just feel like I was so lucky. I didn't know at the time how lucky I was that I, you know, was able to walk in and get hired. And I was the fifth person to ever be hired at Isabel Bloom. You know, when I was hired, there were only four other people plus Isabel who had ever, you know, created or, you know, finished, made these sculptures. So, and I, you know, I was a college student, and so I was kind of in my own little bubble at St. Ambrose, and hadn't really heard of Isabel Bloom, but one of my friends worked there. So when I walked in the front door and expected to see sculpture, I was thinking, you know, fine porcelain sculpture, and I walked into the showroom that was full of big, chunky children, very simple designs, a lot of antiques, and, you know, kind of a dusty room, and the phone was... The telephone was covered with like cement, and I just thought, wow, this is really a working studio. You know, I just fell in love with it the minute I walked in.
So I mean, it was a serendipitous moment for you, and a lot of us take jobs when we're in college or just out of college because it's hard to find a job just out of college. But it sounds like it was also a really pivotal moment for you as an artist. What did you see in this work that moved you?
Well, you know, the sculptures just definitely grew on me, and Isabel was, she grew on me, but a lot quicker than the sculptures did. I mean, the minute I met Isabel, I was just, you know, she had my admiration. And the longer I worked there, the more I learned. And once I became the mold maker, I would be the one that was sent up to Isabel's house to pick up her new designs. She would finish a sculpture, you know, not very often, you know, maybe five or six times a year. And she'd call and say, I've got something. And I would be the one that would get to go pick it up. So then she and I, and her husband John as well, just got to know each other a lot better and became friends. And, you know, that was just such a great opportunity for me.
So even so, though she had sold the business at that time and was in her 70s, she was still guiding the vision?
She was our designer. She was our sculptor, yes. All the sculptures came from Isabel for many, many years after she sold the company.
Did you become, in a way, her apprentice?
You know, it was nothing formal, but I definitely, you know, the owners of the business at that time asked me if I would like to try my hand at sculpting, and I just thought, well, gosh, I'd love to. You know, I had been working with Isabel's designs for so many years, you know, rubbing my hands over them, putting the finish on them. I knew them so well, and, you know, art was my background, too. So it just kind of happened very naturally, and I would take my pieces to Isabel, and she was very well aware that I was creating sculpture. And she, you know, gave me feedback on the designs, and her husband John gave me feedback. So it was just kind of a real natural thing that I, you know, that just kind of happened.
How did you try to capture her vision?
Well, I'm not sure I really did, you know, and I don't think that's what Isabel would expect. I wasn't trying to copy Isabel. I think that my designs are different than Isabel's. I'm a little bit more detailed than Isabel was. And, you know, I sculpt from my heart and soul, just like Isabel did from hers. So most people can really tell the difference. And Isabel wouldn't have wanted me to try to copy her either.
Tell me about the first sculpture that you did that ended up being produced by Isabel Blum.
Well, the first sculpture I did was an angel. It was a plaque, so it hung on the wall. It was a flying angel, and she was playing a harp. So,
when you think about, well, what was the process? I mean, you had been trying to design things and learning and getting feedback when you found out that this one passed muster. What was that moment like?
Yeah, I was so nervous. I mean, and I remember the clay that I used. I didn't even use the right kind of clay, and I didn't have any tools. But, and your hands really are your best tool anyway, so I mostly used my hands and then a few little things that I had picked up, and I still love that sculpture. You know, it has a lot of meaning to me. We don't produce it anymore. We retire. We try to retire as many designs as we bring out new pieces, so that the line doesn't get too out of control. So that piece has been retired for a long time, but I've got one hanging at home in my house, and I still like it.
So as you were being mentored by Isabel, you were also growing as an artist. How did you pursue sculpture outside of Isabel Blum?
Well, I knew that I needed to continue to grow and learn, and I started taking workshops myself. It wasn't Stone City, but it was my little Stone City. But I would sign up for week-long workshops with various artists. At the time, Loveland, Colorado had a little art academy there. They had some bronze foundries there. They had three bronze foundries. So there was quite an art community in Loveland, Colorado. And I would go there every summer and take from a different sculptor. And that really, you know, every sculptor has their own style. They use their own tools. They have their own ways of doing things. And so I would learn from them and just adapt what I wanted. And then, you know, when that place closed down, I started going to Scottsdale. And then after that, I found a great place out in South Carolina. And all of these would be a week-long workshop with one art instructor. And the class was usually about 6 to 12 people in the class. So,
today, how many artists are creating designs for Isabel Blum?
Well, right now it's just me, but I know that, you know, I need to, you know, if we want to carry on this legacy, there needs to be more artists after me. So I'm the only designer, but I do have a team of people that work with me. That's my product development team, and we work together to come up with the ideas. We also get a lot of ideas from our customers and people in the community that are looking for various things. We design a lot of pieces that we use as fundraisers for different nonprofit organizations. So, yeah.
So when you think about, I know that you continue to create this work and sell this work, but when you think about Isabel Blum's legacy as an artist, what do you think it is?
What do I think Isabel's legacy is? Well, it's definitely that she brought affordable art and accessible art to everyone, and she definitely made her mark in this community. Everyone has heard of Isabel Blum, and it's become such a part of people's lives. It's a tradition for people to give an angel to their children at Christmas time, or an egg at Easter time, or a heart for Valentine's Day. I mean, we are a strong tradition in many people's lives, and a big part of the community, and that all started with Isabel.
And when you think about her personal legacy, the woman that you knew, what do you think that is?
Well, I think that is you can do anything that you want to do, and don't let anything stop you. If it's something that you truly believe in, you can find a way to make it work. And just because it hasn't been done before, or just because a lot of people aren't doing it, she kind of just, I guess, followed her own drumbeat, so to speak. And she did it with such grace. And So I guess that's what I've learned from her, is that, you know, if it's something that you really want, you need to go for it.
She passed away when she was 93 years old. Do you think she had a feeling for how many people she had touched through her art?
No, I don't. She was a very humble person, and I think that I think she knew. I mean, the company grew once she sold the company, and the business part of it got more attention. It grew and grew and grew, and I mean, she saw our truck drive by her house once with her name on the side of it in great big letters, and she was just astounded. She called me and said, "What is that?" You know. So no, she didn't have quite a concept on just how many people's lives she was touching.
Well, Donna Young, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Donna Young is co-owner of Isabel Bloom Incorporated. We've been talking about the artist Isabel Bloom this hour on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.